Welcome to Time Code Presents. Today we speak with filmmaker Derek Bridges about his documentary film, The Man in a Red Beret, chronicling the life of chess master Jude Akers. If you don't know about the Red Beret dude handing out beatdowns on the chessboard in the quarters, you ain't from New Orleans. Hosted by Ricardo Barros and Joel Jackson, let's check out Derek as he explains how he hooked up with the Decatur Street legend. Pull out your Red Berets. Here we go.
What's up, Derek? How you doing today, man?
Doing well, JJ.
Yeah, I'm doing good. Somebody's been listening to our podcast. Knows I don't trust people who call me Joel. Except my mama. So we met you recently in the context of you came out to a Time Code screening, and you just released your first filmmaking endeavor, which is a documentary called The Man with the Red Beret.
The Man in the Red Beret.
Man in the Red Beret. It's about the life story of Jude Akers.
Akers is kind of a case on there.
That was my first question.
Yeah.
Was it Akers or Akers? I've driven past his sign a zillion times, and
I've suggested to him for promotional purposes he should have gone with Akers, but it's Akers.
Yeah.
What did he say to you?
He was shocked, actually. And it's interesting because if you see the movie, he's estranged from his family, so it wasn't like he had he had reason to change it if you wanted to.
Right, but was he a curmudgeon about the suggestion?
No, he was just genuinely surprised. I don't think it had ever occurred to him.
Oh, right, yeah. Right. Well, how did you, you've got a pretty interesting story yourself. I know, my understanding is that you wanted to make a film.
Yeah.
And I saw you went to school for creative writing, yeah?
Correct.
And so you're a storyteller.
Yeah.
And I'll let you talk. It sounds like you'd gotten to know Jude through some writing.
Yeah, and photography. I went to grad school for creative writing, and then later on, when I was working at Loyola, I could take classes for free, and so I took all the photography classes I could that Leslie Parts had over there, and then around 2000 or so is when I met Jude at the library where I was working at Loyola. And he would come in at night. And I asked him, you have an exhibition coming up? Let me know and I'll come take pictures. And so that's how I first became friends with him.
Did he have the beret at the library?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
How did that happen? I mean, how did you guys strike up a conversation?
Well, it so happened that there's a writer named Matthew Teague. He's also writes movies now, who wrote a cover article for the Oxford American magazine. And it was about Jude. I think it was called The King of the Decatur Street. And it was a very, very good article. And it really got into Jude's backstory and his family and his time in San Francisco and Haight-Ashbury in the late 60s and early 70s. And I was fascinated. I was like, oh, my God, this guy, he comes in the library sometimes at night,
You're like, there he is.
Yeah. And so I said, hey, I've read this article about you. I was like, I'd love to, come take some pictures at your next exhibition. And he was right into it right away and told me that weekend where he was coffee shop, he was going to do an exhibition against a bunch of kids, a simul.
Okay.
Exhibition. Yeah.
Got it. And so he's been here since what, 1981?
As far as setting up, he grew up here largely, but he's been setting up in that spot on Decatur Street since 81. He bounced around for a few years before that in Jackson Square, Maple Leaf, different places all around town. But he finally settled on that spot in 81. And most of the first half of the 70s and late 60s, he was in San Francisco.
So right.
Late 70s, he made it back here. But he would pass through periodically too, I think.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, so at the same time, your day job is in the video department at Tulane while this is all going down. When you meet Jude?
Nope. When I first met Jude, I was at the library at Loyola. I worked a circulation desk. I'd close the library every night.
Uh-huh.
And then I'd go into a dark room and I'd stay there until 5 in the morning developing stuff or whatever.
Gotcha.
But then fast forward, I wrote the piece about Jude in 2011. I'd gotten back into writing and I started this website called b2l2.com. And I have a bunch of friends from around the country and locally who are artists and writers or unemployed journalists. And I kind of got them all to contribute stuff on a regular basis. And so to kick that off, I returned to the Jude idea. I was like, oh yeah, I should update his story and go deep with him. And so I got together with him at Café du Monde for a few hours and tape recorded the interview and transcribed it all and then wrote this big piece. And as I said, this is 2011, and my friend Trey D'Arc, I was still shooting, I was shooting with a Canon Rebel at that time. And my friend pointed out, Trey said that, people are making movies with those kind of cameras now. You got decent lenses. And so he's the one to kind of put the idea in my head, and that's how we started it.
That's how you started it. Yeah. So it was like a decade in the making.
Yeah, because by then I was working at Loyal as an academic counselor or an assistant director of like a tutoring center and so forth. And then 2015, I lost that job and worked at Delgado for a year, and I was at UNO for a few years in their disability services department. So it wasn't until 2022 that I got hired as a videographer at Tulane.
Wait, okay, so was that based on the experience that you had making this documentary?
Yeah. It's like,
that's wild.
Because early on...
Kind of reverse engineering.
Yeah, I know, it took forever to... Because early on, I didn't want to be these different staff jobs that I had at Loyola and other places. I didn't want to do that kind of stuff. I mean, it was honorable work, nothing wrong with it, but didn't pay very well and wasn't very creative. So I was always on the side hustling photography and writing with this website and all that. But once we started, the idea got planted, we can make this documentary, then we're friends with a bunch of musicians, and so we started doing a couple of music videos and... The idea, okay, and things were kind of busier here in the movie industry back then, right? I mean, yeah. A little bit more hopping. So the idea started to seem more plausible that I could somehow find my way into all that, make a pivot, and so, but when I started, I didn't know how to do anything. I knew how to use a camera, and I knew the story, but I didn't know how to, shoot video and edit it and.
You
sound
learned while making this documentary.
Yeah, entirely. So Trey left the project early on when I started to get taken on these other freelance jobs, and it's going to take a lot longer to do the documentary. So he had another life and bowed out. So then at that point, it was just my friend Caitlin Hanrahan and I. She's someone I met when she was a student at Loyola, and then she graduated, and I lost contact with her. And then it was Uncle Lionel's second line funeral.
Okay.
I was out taking pictures, and I saw her. She was out taking pictures, and I was like, "Oh wow, I didn't know you were into photography." And I just started doing a documentary, and I asked her if she wanted to come along and shoot some with me. And then she became, a partner in the whole project. So she and I did all the shooting. She traveled with me to Croatia and with Jude, and so yeah, she put a lot of time into it too. But Trey was going to be the editor though, so. I was always hoping that she would end up editing it, but that didn't quite happen. So
that was right here.
Then the pandemic happened, and by then I'm working at UNO. I didn't have a lot of stuff to do working from home and mostly having to check email.
In your underwear.
Yeah.
Right. Some people made sourdough.
I learned how to edit. And by then I was doing Final Cut, editing a Final Cut Pro, but then the job I have now at Tulane, I guess it was 2021 or 2020 it was. They had advertised for my job, and one of the descriptions they said, you have to be familiar with the Adobe Creative Suite. And I had never used that, or at least I hadn't used it for a very long time. And I thought, oh man, I can't do it. And so then, okay, I'm gonna learn Premiere now. That's a good excuse to dive deeper into editing. I just learned this other software. And then, so a year later, I learned enough where I actually got the job and then, push through finishing editing the movie and everything.
And so what are you doing? What kind of filmmaking are you doing at Tulane?
Okay, so I'm the videographer for the School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. So it's basically, it's marketing and communications.
Yeah.
So we're telling the school's story or message. It's messaging. We're implementing its messaging. But it's, I don't know if you know much about those folks at Public Health and Tropical Medicine, they're really amazing, super cool people. I mean, they're doing great, important work. And so my values align with them. So it's like
fun stories and your values align.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And I get to do the stuff now during the day, all day, and I learn that much faster and I enjoy doing it still. Way more than I ever enjoyed any of the other jobs I had.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And I saw they did a screening at the...
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. So I work with a communications on a communications team. There's a writer, there's a web person, and there's a social media guy who also does writing, and then me, I'm the videographer. So we work in concert together, coming up with ideas and so forth. And so, yeah, my supervisor, yeah, the dean of the School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine is Thomas Leviste, and he's a documentary filmmaker in his own right. Wow. Very good movie. I think it'll probably be, he's doing a new edit of it that'll be out next year, but I've seen it. It's an excellent movie. It's a very good story. I think it's called The Skin You're In.
Okay.
But yeah, watch out for that. It's going to be a very smart, very interesting about the social determinants of public health and through his kind of personal narrative growing up in New York and everything.
Yeah. This seems like one of those stories that exemplifies, like, you make your own luck.
Yeah.
Like, you worked hard and kind of know what your values are, and then you get lucky to find this place.
That was the hope, you know?
Yeah.
Just like...
And it sounds like you grinded through some administration. Was that your whole track, like, coming out? You went to what, Illinois State? Is that right?
Yeah. So undergrad, I studied journalism at Illinois State. And then I did grad school at University of Southern Mississippi for a few years in the creative writing program, studying with Frederick Barthelme, great writer, smartest guy I've ever met. But I would get my MA there, but then I met my first wife, and she was getting her second bachelor's in writing there. That's a long other sort of story. But anyway, I met her, fell in love. She finished her second bachelor's, and then we got into the University of Florida's creative writing program together for MFA. So that's where I ended up getting my MFA. It was in Gainesville.
Got it.
Great writers there too. But it was an exhausting time going through all that. So finished in 95, 96, our kid is born. We're in Illinois. And I talked her into moving back to New Orleans. My ex-wife was from New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
And I started visiting here with her in the 90s, especially when we were in Hattiesburg, you know, come down for Jazz Fest and everything. And,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. I fell in love with New Orleans my initial story about New Orleans, you know, when I was at Illinois State University, I worked at the college newspaper for a few years. I wrote a column and so forth. And back then, those newspapers still existed, right? They made money. They had advertising.
Yeah.
And even my college paper, this was a daily. It printed a daily paper Monday through Friday. On Friday, they had a big entertainment section they would put out, too, in this small town, you know? It was like competed with the major, the city paper. Anyway, so I convinced the people who ran the paper to let me take the car that we leased. And a credit card and a couple other reporters with me to come to New Orleans to cover Mardi Gras.
Wow.
I was like, it's screaming for a college paper to cover it. We should go. And so that was 89. And so so that was my first experience in New Orleans. And it was, you know, nuts. And I was probably an idiot. But so then in the early 90s, I started coming for Jazz Fest. And my ex-wife, her grandfather was a jazz musician. He led the Young Tuxedo Brass Band until he died in the mid-80s. And so that was like my first real interest in New Orleans was like brass band culture and everything.
Yeah.
And when I first moved here, because I'd, you know, seen the Tuxedos a few times at Jazz Fest and knew about Dr. Michael White. I looked up, again, this is a different era, I looked up the phone book and I found Dr. Michael White's phone number and gave him a call. And he met me for coffee and just told me about all the history of brass bands in New Orleans and jazz.
Amazing.
New Orleans jazz. And yeah, he was so gracious.
I met him one time too. I worked at the Contemporary Arts Center and met him, and I was in the Performing Arts Department. Great, great.
He's an amazing dude. Yeah.
That's so wild though that you just, you kind of went for it from, you know, taking that trip on the newspaper's dime to.
Right. Well, that was the fun thing about journalism that I liked. And this is only college journalism, but it's just like, it gives you access to things and it makes you want to go try to.
Right.
You can just show up. And
New Orleans is great for access to things, too, because there is no real celebrity status here. It's just, like you said, you talk to Dr. Michael White, just call them up.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think even Fats Domino would take appointments with people. Like, if you called him in time, he'd say, okay, come by at 1 o'clock, and he would host you in his home.
Amazing.
Yeah, I've heard that. I don't know how true that is, but
that's wild.
Yeah, it's stories.
Sounds plausible to me.
Stories I've heard. Do you remember, like, from coming the early times that you came, because Jude Acres is such a visible character, such a visible person, like with the red beret. If you don't know who we're talking about by name, Jude Acers is the person that you always see on Decatur Street if you're passing that way, set up by playing chess.
Right by the Gazebo Cafe.
Yeah, right by the Gazebo Cafe, playing chess or waiting for somebody to play chess with the red beret on. And he's one of those things that it's just, for me, it's time immemorial. Like, I don't recall New Orleans without him, except for, you could tell me more about that. There seemed like there was a time where he wasn't around for a minute.
I think, it's, you know, since 81, he's been pretty consistently there, except, you know, obviously Katrina.
Yeah, I think it was the Katrina thing.
But he was, even Katrina, he was here for Katrina and then got evacuated after Katrina for a while and then made his way back after a few weeks. But yeah, he has that's a whole journey too for him. But but folks, you know, he got some. I think Michael Tizeran wrote an article for U.S. Chess Life magazine, and people sent him some money to help him get back and stuff. So yeah, he's always had people kind of looking out
for him. Do you remember the first time being conscious of him?
You know, I really think it was in the library. I don't think it was on Decatur Street.
Really?
Yeah, because in the library at night, he'd come back then. This is the old Loyola Library. They have a really beautiful new one. The old building isn't there anymore, I don't think. He would come. They had only like a half dozen public computers that people can use back then. And he'd come in, and maybe no one else would be using computers, but he'd be like using three or four. You know, he'd be popping around, playing a game on one, writing something on another. You know, he just had a lot of stuff going on there. And so that stuck out. And
a person using three or four computers.
He's got a red beret, and he's got a red, you know, hoodie on, and you know, whatever. And then, like I said, the Oxford American article, then that really kind of sealed it. That I really wanted to, wow, there's a whole lot going on here with this guy.
Okay, so as many times as I've seen him, like, you know, skated past him and just been, like, in close proximity, I don't think I've ever talked to him. So what's he like?
I mentioned my ex-wife earlier. I give her credit. She described it really well. She said he speaks with commas, not periods. You know, it just keeps coming. It just keeps coming. And so, like, say I go out there sometimes and I try to, like, I want to kind of cover this up with him. I want to ask him these couple things. And I may get that first one, but then he starts, you know, answering. And it gets so complicated so fast. There's lots of asides. There's lots of detours.
Like, talks, like, parenthetically?
Yeah, it goes deep. So it can get confusing, you know? And he's so intense. He just keeps going. And it's funny, you can see him talking to people. You're, like, standing next to him. He'll put his hand on you and kind of, like, keep you in position a little bit, you know?
Like a boxer that'll hold you there so he can punch
you
squarely.
It's a very innocent thing, but it's just kind of, like, it's a physical engagement.
That's intense.
Yeah, but he's so gracious, though, you know, and that's like the thing I think comes through in the movie, I hope. You know, he has a big ego. He thinks the world of himself. I mean, he really thinks super highly of himself. Which,
as a player or in general?
In every way. As a player, for sure. He's as a player, as a chess presence, as a chess authority. Storyteller, he really prides himself on being able to hold a room and do give a lecture, and be, you know, on point and efficient and artistic.
So he's an extrovert,
very, very, very much so. But he comes at you, and there's not a lot of times for you to say things. You know,
so, are you a chess player?
I know how to play chess, I've never been a serious player. I admire the game. I'm more fascinated than ever about the game. But as I mentioned earlier, I kind of made a decision earlier that I didn't have time to really get too deep into the arcana of chess and lose myself into the magic of the game. I know it's there. I recognize it's there. But I just didn't have time to do that too. So and also that was always going to be a tricky thing in this movie, was how much the chess stuff do I get in there, you know, how quickly am I going to lose people when I start talking about E4, this and that, you know. I kind of stay focused on the stories of it all, but I got to respect the chess heads out there too, and trying to give them just enough to feel like they weren't cheated on that front, you know.
Did he have any input or feedback? And he's like, I don't want you telling too much about my game, or
That's one of the amazing things about it. He's kind of an absolutist about freedom, right? And everyone's rights, and so he's like, it's your freedom of expression, it's your thing. He's like, you do whatever you want to do, and there's nothing off limits. You know, there's nothing he dodged. Other than we all dodge things, but you know, he didn't swear anything off. You know,
well, and was he happy with the outcome?
He's thrilled with it.
Yeah,
he loves it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Great.
He sends so many emails to people about it. He's like, you know, and like, okay, that's what I wanted to say earlier about, okay, you know, he has a substantial ego, a very big ego, but he's so complimentary and gracious about everyone around him. Like, I'm Francis Ford Coppola, you know, and I laugh harder than everyone at that. and you know, and Caitlin, his greatest photographer ever, you know, is that kind of stuff. So it's a very upbeat, generous spirit that I think makes it all work.
Yeah. Knowing nothing about chess myself, not only the game but the whole hierarchy or national scene or whatever, is there rankings?
Yep. I think his highest ranking, I think, was back in early 70s, it was like he was 25th in the country. So he made the top 50 list in like the US, USCF rankings. So that he was right. And that's like there's a controversy about it. The USCF froze his rating for many, many decades because of some controversy about how, see, Jude, he loves the game so much. He wants every single person he meets to play the game. And so there was a saying where someone may not be a member of US Chess Federation, but they can still play a rated game. And there's, you know, you buy them pay their membership, and then they're in this rated game. So Jude played a bunch of games against people who were very low rated, and he might pick up a point or two here and there, and then bring his rating up to almost, he was like on the cusp of senior master statuses. There's a national master, senior master, international master, grandmaster. And so he was on the cusp of senior master. And so anyway, so his rating was frozen for a long time. He stopped playing in USCF tournaments. But then he has proved his mettle in international tournaments. Like 7 years in a row, he went to the FIDE World Senior Chess Championship tournament in various cities in Europe. They have it rotates around, and that's why we went to in Croatia. So,
okay.
So a lot of great players, some legends of his generation, and there were like 201 players. He finished 67th in that tournament, and that wasn't his best. The year before, he finished as the highest ranking American player, I think, in 2012.
How is that funded? How does he fund his lifestyle and his tournament goings?
Fat Cats International is the name. He has some anonymous benefactors who he has only identified to me as Fat Cats International.
You're kidding.
No.
Wow.
And they funded those 7 years of trips. And I think, you know, there's other folks who and there's like different people have stepped up over the years. And there's a local attorney named Charles Broom. Jude refers to him as Charles the First Citizen Broom. He gives everyone nicknames, you know. One time Jude was down on luck and couldn't pay his rent, and Charles drove up to the table and gave him $1,000 to pay his rent, you know, stuff like that. So he's had people who've helped him out along the years like that. And in the early 70s, I mean, he toured and he made, I don't think he made much money, but he did like about 4 years where he's traveling around the country and Greyhound buses, and he had a manager who would book all this stuff. So, there, you know, it's after Bobby Fischer won the world championship, there's a boom, kind of like
right.
Queen's Gambit boom, you know.
Yeah.
So he's had some peaks here and there, you know. But he's the folks down there in the neighborhood where his table is, there's the French Market Seafood Restaurant and Bar. He gets free meals from them. Cafe Spizas gives him free meals.
Yeah, he's an icon.
Yeah, and after Katrina, he pitched in at seafood restaurant, French Market restaurant, and helped bus tables and stuff like that for a while.
Nice.
But
does
yeah.
he live in the quarter?
Yeah. Yeah, he's lived, he had a place for a long time. You'll see in the documentary that apartment he had several years ago, it appears, and that was like a third floor of a building. He had to leave, Scotty Hill, he was a trad jazz musician, he owned that building, and he was friends with Jude, he let him live up there. So then Scotty died, and Jude had to move out, and he got an apartment right across the street from his table for a while, during a pandemic, on the third floor. And then I think there was an incident with forgetting to turn the water off in his tub, and he had to move out.
Oh, shit.
But Bailey Badaway, young woman who's befriended him, who was like the ending of the documentary, she found him a really, really nice apartment in the quarter. So he's got a great place now. So.
And you guys just had a screening of what, on April 3rd, just recently? Was that his birthday?
Yeah, it was leading up to his birthday. His birthday was on the 6th. Yeah, he just turned 80. We had a screening at the Jazz Museum that Wednesday before that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. And he must have just been picking shit with the...
He loved it. Yeah, he was like really happy, and yeah, he's been to every single screening I've had locally. Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Does he do a Q&A?
Yeah, or not all of them. Not all of them, but usually at some point he'll extol my greatness. So that's always awesome. And he said, and so Bailey has created. She works for the Jazz and Heritage Foundation. She does digital marketing for them. She created a nonprofit called the Red Beret Chess Foundation to promote his legacy and promote chess in New Orleans. So she does. She did a presentation at the recent artificial intelligence conference that was at the Jazz Museum. So she does a little. So after a couple of the screenings, some of the screenings, she's done a presentation about the history of chess in New Orleans and artificial intelligence and chess.
Oh wow!
To promote her nonprofit and
And what's the name of the nonprofit?
It's the Red Beret Chess Foundation.
Got it.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds.
She has a little place around the corner from him on St. Philip Street called the Chess Cave. Literally hole in the wall, like 150 square feet. There's a room in there, but that's like the headquarters for her nonprofit. And she has like chess tournaments there. Nakamura, the number three player in the world in chess, he visited the Chess Cave last year or year before last.
That's great. So it's a living history and the legacy will continue.
And she's promoting with kids and all kinds of great things.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. That's really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. She's
How's this AI part of it working?
Well, the thing about chess is it was like kind of a front runner in terms of how AI influences things, right? So you had the big blue computer that beat Kasparov.
Right, that goes back 30, that's a long 40 time ago, years right. or something.
Yeah.
It's the first time man versus computer, right?
Right.
And if you remember, y'all were around then too, I believe. People were like, oh my God, chess is dead kind of thing. It was like, how do you keep playing when you know that can happen? You know, there's sort of the vibe of it all.
Sure, I remember that.
But when you look at it now, the game is more popular than ever. And like, players use artificial intelligence to improve their play. All the top players use that to train.
Sure.
And there's still a whole thing like artificial intelligence. I mean, there's some engines that are like so crazy good. Like there's one that Bailey talks about, this like a 3,500 rating. I mean, just off the charts kind of thing. And anyway, so just saying that it's had a profound influence and hasn't been as negative as people anticipated. Not to say this could be the case with anything else, but just noting that.
Yeah, I think that was around the time of War Games too, when that the chess versus computer was happening. We were all super.
Oh right, yeah.
We were shitting ourselves over over computers and.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot to reckon with. But yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It turned out great for Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
When you first started the or committed to the project, did you kind of understand the arc of the story that you were telling? I mean, you know who the character is, right?
No, I felt like I knew it really well because I'd written that wrong. The article I wrote was like 25,000 words, you know.
Wow.
So it went into a lot of great detail and then just lots of Jude talking. So yeah, I really felt confident about the story. I knew the things I wanted to hit and I knew there would be new things that would come up.
Did you feel that the piece that you wrote was the basis for what you were going to do? You were going to put it in the...
Yeah, I mean... It wouldn't be, given the nature of the medium, right? It wouldn't be able to get into that kind of detail, right? But it would hit a lot of those major themes and points and events in his life. Now, I couldn't cover, there's so much I couldn't get into in the movie that I would like to have. Like, I didn't really get too deeply into his time in San Francisco and his writing. He had a really interesting writing career there when he was in San Francisco. He wrote for the.
I was going to ask what brought him to San Francisco. He was there in that sort of special time.
Well,
there.
Chess too. It was he just graduated LSU '68, and he played some chess tournament in Denver. I want to say. I don't know. I should know this because it's in the documentary.
Well, people can watch the documentary as well.
He got a credit card. He had a Shell credit card, and some other chess players wanted to go to San Francisco, and he said, "Let's go." That's basically what happened. So he was free as a bird kind of at the time. And so in San Francisco, Mechanics Institute is a very famous, notorious chess club. And so he was like in that scene there. And he had a friend, Max Burkett was his name, a chess player who lived in Haight-Ashbury and allowed you to sleep on his couch. And this is, you know, that's where Jude met Janis Joplin and the Doors and Bill Graham. And
he bullied them around in chess.
I think he was just like this, cause the other thing about Jude, he's never drank. He's never smoked anything. Never done any drugs, clean as whistle on that stuff. So he was like an anomaly in that world. Right?
Sure.
So he's in the bathtub during a party with his chessboard, you know. I don't think he was in the water. I think he was just in.
For sure.
And then Janis Joplin using the toilet next to him and stuff and hitting it off. Because, you know, they have Louisiana connection too. I think that probably helped. So while he was there, though, he wrote a regular column for the Berkeley Barb alternative weekly newspaper called Chess Barbs or The Road, different names, I think. But, and really, I'd be happy to share the writings with you. Really great stuff. A lot of bizarre events. Of course, he's the only source on a lot of events, but he was at Altamont when the Rolling Stones were there and the whole Hell's Angels thing. He was an eyewitness to all that.
So he was kind of capturing the zeitgeist.
Right. And he writes about Janis Joplin and all these other folks.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really, so I think that could be, it'd be a great animated movie, animating those stories.
Oh, yeah. There.
But yeah, I just couldn't figure out how to do it in the movie.
And how's the reception been with the film? You said local screenings, but you've been in festivals.
Yeah, it's played. In Abita Springs, they have a new film festival up there, and it played and won the feature doc award there. And it was really fun. It was because, you know, they're kind of local, right?
Right.
And so a lot of those folks who were at the screening knew of Jude, like the Landmark thing. So I think it was really fun to see it in that audience. They were really into it. They were very enthusiastic. It was fun talking to them about it. Just a couple months ago, it was in the Prison City Film Festival in Huntsville, Texas. Huntsville, if you don't know, it's called Prison City because there's a whole bunch of prisons there. They execute people there. So they're leaning into the branding on that. I have a soft spot for the place because that's my parents retired there in the early aughts. I have a soft spot for Huntsville, so it was fun to go to the festival there. And yeah, and I won the best feature doc there, and that was super cool. And it just, you know, it's just kind of like going to the, I'll plug them and plug you all because, like, it's a lot like going to Tom Code Nola meetups. It's just fun to, thrilling for me to be around other filmmakers. I'm not even used to calling myself that yet. So, you know, it's just, it's an honor and a privilege to be able to, like, just, you know, talk to folks and learn their stories and how they go about things and what projects they're going to do and pitch and tell them ideas I have. And so it's just fun being in that mix. And I had a great time in Huntsville doing that with other filmmakers. There's some really cool people there.
What are you thinking about next? Or now?
Currently? I have a lot of ideas. Oh, my Lord. Well, you know, I want to write something, a scripted piece, you know, short, that I can shoot on my own. I've been working on a script for on and off for a few years on that. So I'm holding it. That's probably top of the list. And then I have like kind of a crazy ambitious idea, writing about this historical figure, kind of like, you know, you all seen Deadwood, right? HBO? Yeah. An historical drama set in Louisiana, 1860s and 1870s, following the life of this carpetbagger who came down here and things didn't go well. So it's a time period I'm finding really interesting. It's being a northerner coming here. Something I've grappled with. There's, you know, you make a documentary and people come up with you with documentary ideas a lot, you know.
Yeah.
So I've had a I've had several people sort of pitching me ideas, you know, and that's kind of fun.
Sure.
And there's one I don't think I really need to do much to help this person, John McCusker. I don't know if you all know him. He's a really great photographer. He worked for the Times Picayune for many years. And brilliant guy. And he does like jazz history tours. He wrote a book about Kid Ory a few years ago, and he had the Kid Ory Museum out at Whitney Plantation. Anyways, he wants to do a documentary about New Orleans jazz history, and he's basically written a text for it already. And he went to NOCA with Wendell Pierce.
Yeah.
And so he did the voice for his Kid Ory Museum and stuff. So I want to maybe be a producer role helping him facilitate.
That's fun.
Yeah. And there's a few other like that, ideas like that.
Having your background was in writing. You went to school many years and written, I'm sure.
Yeah.
A whole lot. And you're talking about like writing something to film. How does that change your writing process?
It's interesting. It's like I always try to write short stories with the idea of writing a novel at some point. And that was always my dream. And I did all those years in writing workshops, just kind of grueling stuff. And I don't know, and then I tried to write a lot on my own, and it never quite clicked, and I think it got in my head, and there's something about the form of trying to write a screenplay that is liberating to me, and it's like, I just find when I'm working in that form, I'm not as stuck about things, I'm not as precious about it, maybe, too. You know?
Yeah, that's a good word, precious.
Yeah.
Because in storytelling, particularly if you're thinking about a novel,
yeah,
or a short story that's going to lead to a novel, it feels like every decision you make carries so much gravity.
Yes.
And it's so fucking precious.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a great question, Rick. And I wonder too, when you're actually directing a film, I mean, obviously you had what you wrote about Jude as a map with making the documentary. But I'm curious if you think that your approach with your next film project, if you see it like the way you approach writing a creative story, if there's some parallels there.
Yeah, I think it'd be a different animal just because, the way I went about this documentary was so wrong in so many ways, probably, you know. And there was an element of, you know, I think it was Renee Coleman. He's the bass player of the Iguanas, and he has his Trouble of Men podcast. And okay. He's a friend of Jude's, and he had us on. We talked. He had Jude on, too.
Nice.
And one thing, he has a theory. It took us so long because we had so much fun with Jude. And so I think that's some truth in that, because we had a lot of fun. It was the most fun part was just going down there and aimlessly shooting and hanging out with Jude.
Right.
And whatever happens in front of us, sometimes you catch some gold, right? Find some gold. But then when you have to sit down and try to really make something out of it, that's when it gets really hard. So in terms of the scripting, that's what appeals to me now. About 7 years ago, I started joining Backyard Shed Films on their 48-hour film contest. I'd be their second camera unit because I wanted to see that process and how the scripted work gets done, because I'd been doing all this weird documentary approach. So it's so different, you know, you're building it all, you know, you're not just finding it. And so that appeals me. And I think having that sort of physicality of it too is freeing from the page. And there's always going to be a gap from the page to what happens on the screen. So I think that there's a lot of room there for a lot of creative choices.
Yeah, there's also a lot of limitation involved, just like something that you're writing might seem simple to do. Like maybe you have a scene like in the lobby of a bank or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you actually think about like, wait, how am I going to film this? Like, is that something that you're conscious
That's
of?
That's exactly
in your
what I'm
process?
Thinking. I'm trying to be very deliberate about that. Yeah. In this short, I'm coming, trying mm-hmm. to. My HBO feature thing series has, I don't care about any of that. But in terms of the thing I'm actually going to try to shoot, yeah, I'm trying to be really, really deliberate. But can I actually do what I'm writing?
Right.
Yeah. So that's going to change. That's going to force my hand in different ways, I guess. But
you enjoy that limitation?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I think, yeah, having limitations, it's like making a documentary. We're limited by the technology we're using. We're limited by the historical moment. It just all limits come up in so many ways. And you just got to be, that's where a lot of the fun is, too. You know, it's like finding a way around what seemed like an something you just couldn't surmount, you know. I think, you know, that's happy accidents. It's all the same in that way. Now, of course, I'm approaching this. I'm not going to be having a big crew or anything. I'm not going to be like on the clock paying people.
Right. Well, that's part of the other. You have to really simplify what you're planning to.
Yeah, I'm not really a filmmaker in that sense yet. You know, I'm not like.
No. Yeah. I mean, you can't delegitimize what you're doing, but you have to be. you have to actually do it. You have to actually film it. So, like, it's part of the planning, and it starts. You're helping yourself out if you're thinking about it in the writing.
Absolutely.
In the writing portion of the process.
That's exactly where I'm coming from in that. Yeah.
Yeah, but then again, you don't want to. You know, you want to shoot at just the right level. You don't want to undershoot what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel when you saw like the first cut of the final Acres documentary?
You know, the thing is, I kept editing, though. I thought I was done. I sent to some film festivals, and then I kept editing. You know, a lot of it wasn't very big. It wasn't huge surgery or anything like that. So it feels like it hasn't been that long. So I feel like it's when I finally got to the point where I feel like, yeah, it's done. And then I still did a couple other more things, but I really wasn't substantial. It was such a relief burden. Because, like, my partner is Caitlin, and we kind of got estranged. She got mad at me during the editing process. And she's kind of, what's that?
The camera.
The director of photography in this case. And she was, you know, my partner. And she's come around recently, which is really heartening, I have to say. She came to the Jazz Museum and screening it, in fact. So I think I'm going to call that the final one. And that was really, because, you know, we started this 2012. Most people knew in 2013. And it's like, that's what everyone would say to me for the whole 10 years. Like, how's the documentary going? You almost done with the documentary? When are you going to finish the documentary? You're not going to finish the documentary. It's like constantly, you know? So it's like, you don't want to be like so run off by that kind of stuff that you make bad decisions, but you got to get your shit together and get it done, you know? Jude turned 80 this week, you know, last week, so a couple weeks ago. So that, you know, no one's guaranteed anything. I'm not guaranteeing anything, you know? So yeah, I wanted to get it done before we all died.
Yeah, it's funny because I was like what you're saying right now about you get talking about getting objectivity on the overall project. You're talking about doing sort of something on somebody's life. So taking 10 years to do something about that, it's not ridiculous. Right. It's totally viable to think that that's like that you're doing it justice, but you do have to finish eventually. As well, and I was kind of thinking of the same thing. How do you get the objectivity when you're editing? You know what I mean? Like, because it's a documentary, so you're telling the story, and things are going to be revealed as you go. Mm-hmm. It's going to have a different impact the first time you watch it.
Yeah.
So you've seen it 100 times. You're in the process of editing it. You already know all the things. It's to me, it'd be very, very much a challenge to like, is this being presented? Like, is this? Is it cohesive?
Like you got too legible, close to it, sort of?
It's hard to get, anytime you're working on your own art, you know, to be objective about it, because you want to experience it as other people will, and especially the documentary, because you want somebody to grasp the thread of the story with one viewing.
Yeah.
You're not trying to confuse it, but you already know the ending when you watch the beginning, so.
Were you cognizant of that?
Yeah. Okay, so of course, I would try to do mind game with myself, get myself into the space where I can, where it feels like I'm clean and clear and seeing it fresh. Of course, it's of limited utility, I suppose. But the biggest help I had was my original partner in this was Trey D'Arc, right? So we reconnected. We became good friends again after he left the project. And he went on to, you know, he was like, went to North Carolina and worked for Team Penske, and he was doing a 3D modeling of the car. He had good things going on. Anyway, so during the pandemic, I started really drilling down on editing, and that's when I started sharing edits with him a lot. And he gave me a lot of really good feedback. So I think he was the primary person in terms of having an objective voice. And his wife, April, too, watched a lot, too, and she gave me some real good feedback. And I'd play for a few other people here and there that gave me good feedback. In fact, there's one, my friend Hayan Khan, locally, I had already submitted to film festivals and stuff. And then I cut it down because I started getting in my head about the length of features and how the math of film festivals is so brutal. It's like, oh, this is 90, almost 100 minutes. I got to get down to 90 minutes. So I cut out some stuff and I played for him. And he had seen some earlier edits and he said, oh, he really liked it a lot. He says, but what about that footage about him in his apartment? Why is it he took that out? I was like, and as soon, the moment he said it to me, I was like, oh my God, I know exactly where that goes. And then I put it in and it worked, you know. So there were those kind of moments that like were checking me.
You know? When you were getting close to the ending of it, or what you thought was going to be the ending, did you think like, oh, I'm missing something. I need to go back and get some. I'm missing this piece.
Well, as I said, there were the things that, you know, I had to follow the footage. I can only use what I have unless I have to shoot something else, like you said. And yeah, I would have liked to have traveled to San Francisco and interview people there and get
the
sites.
Did you toy with that idea of actually doing
that? I did. I did. In fact, there's one interview I did in the movie for did via Zoom. That when the pandemic broke, I had made arrangements to interview this guy. His name's John Donaldson. He's a international master. He's a chess writer, scholar, chess Olympiad captain, and all that. He's insane, and he's ran the Mechanics Chess Club for many years in San Francisco. Anyway, really great chess authority, and I had arranged to meet him in St. Louis because that's like the chess capital these days. And then the pandemic happened. He couldn't make the trip, and I couldn't make the trip. You know, so I was on the cusp of doing some of those things I wanted to do. But yeah, I could. So the whole writing career part of it, I just couldn't get into the documentary. So that one sticks with me a little bit. I have an idea though. If anyone wants to fund this, a sequel called Jude Akers Rides Again, and in this movie, we go to all these places, these little towns that he writes about in his columns back in the day. And we can kind of relive some of those stories that he wrote about, and he can do a Czech exhibition in town and, you know, and play a bunch of kids and so forth and give a lecture. And
that's cool.
Yeah. So there's I think that would be, and he's totally down for that, by the way. I told him that idea.
He loves it. Sounds like he's excited about anything about it.
Do a documentary tour around all these places. Yeah. And you also pull that thread of the stories that he
folding
wrote.
In those stories.
Folding yeah. in those stories. Yeah. Holy cow, that's a good idea.
And if we get an animator involved to do some of the story animations, that
such
could be pretty
a
cool.
good idea.
Yeah. So
it seems like you could get some funding for that.
Yeah. I'm time code NOAA listeners.
We talked about AI and chess.
Yeah.
Have you thought any about AI and writing and filmmaking?
Not the writing. I find that really distasteful. But it did help me. You know, there's an interview in the documentary where we interviewed Marilyn Pelias in the Ritz on Canal Street, and there was some harp music in the background. So I was an idiot. It's like, why didn't we do their interview there with this harp music? But then 8 years later or so, there's an AI tool I found that can pull the sounds out and all that. And so it made it like pass kind of okay. You know?
Yeah.
Kind of saved your ass on that one.
Yeah. So I have a little warm spot.
I mean, it's hard to argue with something like that, but you know.
But yeah, as far as the writing tools and all that, yeah. I don't see it.
For any sort of really creative task, you know.
Why are you doing it if you're going to use that? I mean, it seems like it takes all the fun out of it or something.
Right. Like storyboarding, I could see it being a useful tool.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, so facilitation.
You up on social media?
A little bit. Yeah, there's
where could somebody find you?
Instagram, The Man in the Red Beret, all one word. And on Facebook, The Man in the Red Beret as well.
Consistency is good.
Yeah, yeah.
And where can people watch the movie?
They can't. They cannot do that. Yeah, I still play. There are still some more film festivals I submitted to. I gotta let that play out. I like to do another screenings locally at some point. And then at some point find a way to stream it somewhere.
Yeah,
that's the ultimate ending, I think.
Yeah,
for where it goes.
And are you thinking like distribution or just you putting it out there?
I don't know what the word means. I don't know how. I don't even know that world. You know?
Yeah.
I just been like, what's in front of me every step of the way, sure. And that's like the next thing in front of me. I got to figure out, right?
Yeah, you got to just go at it, right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's a great method. If you want to do something, just do it. You'll figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, make a movie first, then figure out some.
It'll reveal itself. Yeah, and you'll meet people that'll
hopefully. Yeah, but if anyone locally wants to screen it anywhere, let me know. We can.
Yeah, I'd like to watch it.
I know. Yeah. A little long for a time called Noah meetup, though, but you know, it's like 99 minutes and 20 seconds, I think.
We never know. Maybe, I don't know. We'll see what could happen. But thanks for coming out and talking to us.
It's a blast. I feel so honored to come to this table to talk to you all. Y'all do such great work. I love everyone you talk to in the show and on this podcast. And the movies, I liked the Ben Long's movie last, the smoothie, Why Smoothie? Whatever.
Oh, I love that. I'm so glad you said that.
Fucking masterpiece.
That was one of my favorite things.
It was so fun.
I haven't laughed that hard.
No.
Like,
yeah.
That blew my mind.
And I just met Ben a few, like a month or two earlier, so I was really happy that he submitted to the time code, Noah, and that you'll
enjoy great.
So much. Yeah. Yeah. This has been a blast for me. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. And we're going to have another seat for you when you finish the next one.
Awesome. I'll be
happy. We'd like to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to start watching it at some point. Yeah.
Cool.
Thanks, Derek. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time Code Presents is produced by Ricardo Barros and hosted by Joel Jackson and Ricardo Barros. Special thanks to our guest, Derek Bridges. Go check out his film, The Man in the Red Beret, streaming now on Amazon and Tubi. Also, go follow Derek and his exploits in the world at The Man in the Red Beret. Don't DM about battling chess. You don't want none of that. But if you want to stay up on what we're doing at Time Code, go ahead by checking out timecodenola.com or just ask somebody. Later.